Hello and welcome to Margin Driving Podcast 147. My name's Terry Frost, and this time we're doing Freddy and the Pig. We're going to start out with the original 1984 Wes Craven movie, Nightmare on Elm Street, starring Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp. Then we're moving forward to 2017 for an Australian giant pig movie. No, it's not Razorback, Russell Mulcahy's movie from a few decades ago. It is Boar, B-A-O-R, which, among other people, has some really classic Australian actors. It's got Steve Bisley in it, Ernie Dingo's in it, John Jarrett, and Roger Ward. So sit back and I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start this show going. Martian Driving Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema for as little as a dollar a week. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. Okay, how is everybody? This is going to be the last Martian Drive-In podcast of 2018, which has been a kind of interesting year. It's very hot here at the moment. It's kind of hovering just under 100 in old school language. And I have a beer. I don't normally have beer when I'm podcasting, so this is all going to be a little bit random. I picked it up at Aldi, which is a big German chain store, supermarket. And it's called Black Sheep IPA, and it's made in Yorkshire, and they imported it all the way across the planet so that I can drink it on the podcast. Let's see, it's 5.1%, and I've got 500 mils of it, which is half a litre. So I'm not going to get pissed on the podcast, but it's kind of nice having a beer in this kind of weather. I don't normally drink beer or any kind of alcohol most of the year, but when the weather gets really hot and sunny and oppressive in the nicest possible way, then I don't mind a beer, and I'm going to have one while I'm doing the podcast. As always, we're following the Richard rule, which is that I've got to start talking about the movies 15 minutes into the podcast so that Richard H, who's a Patreon supporter of the podcast, knows when to scrub to. So we survived the Yuletide season. I invented a new holiday because I can. And it's called Newton Fest. It's not Newton Mass anymore. It's Newton Fest because I had a chat with a Jewish scholar of my acquaintance. And she said, if you have Mass on the end of it, it's still religious connotation. So you've got to find something else if you want to have a totally secular celebration in and around the 25th of December. So Newton Mass can't happen. I agreed with her because you never disagree with a learned Jewish scholar and Hi Jillian. And so Newton Fest was born, and I did some logos for it and put them up on Facebook. And as a rule, they were kind of well received. So I'm still working out the mythology of the holiday, but I will do that. And I've got 10 rules of Newton Mass that I put up on Facebook, and I'll actually put them in the show notes of the podcast too while I remember it. And that'll be a little bit of fun for you. So we survived that, went to the Outlaws and had dinner. One of the reasons I'm doing one of the movies for this podcast is because of the season as well. But I'll talk about that after the 15-minute mark so Richard can hear. I also put out a couple of YouTube videos, as is my want these days. One on my top 10 movies of 2018 and one of my worst 10 movies of 2018. And it seems to have got a bit of a result because I now have 109 YouTube subscribers. You can be one too if you go to youtube.com/C for Charlie/Terry Frost, all in lowercase, and you'll be able to find my YouTube page. And again, I'll link it to the notes because I'm doing a lot of stuff that relates to movies, and there's a few surprising things I'm going to be doing in each episode over the next well, I'd say next 5 or 6 episodes of the YouTube channel, which are going to be movie related. Most of the stuff there is movie related. There's a little bit of vlogging on there as well, because I want to kind of learn that a lot better. And it does set me up nicely for the trip to Japan that Sally and I are doing in April. So, yeah, there's lots of things happening here. The weather, as I said, is warm. It's kind of had a slow start. We're getting this weird thing with climate change where Melbourne doesn't get very warm until late December these days, and then it gets really warm. It gets really hot. Most of the state of Victoria at the moment is doing about 110 old school, about 40-odd degrees in centigrade, the measurement by which most of the planet measures temperature. And, yeah, so it's going to be like that for a month or two. I never complain about that, and I kind of worked out why. There's a deep and kind of sad psychological reason why I can't stand the cold, but I like the warmth. I did talk it over with a psychologist, and she pretty much confirmed my theory about this. Once upon a time, in the very early 1990s, I was homeless. Actually, it was earlier than that. Would have been the early 80s, in fact. Fortunately, it was only for a short time, but it was in the middle of a Melbourne winter, which I know in the scale of things around the planet is not a particularly severe winter. But when all you've got is the clothing you're wearing on your back, it can be very, very cold. And I slept out in the open during a Melbourne winter wearing a big army greatcoat I had and a beanie, and it was crazy cold for a few nights. And it has had a profound and prolonged effect on me. And psychologically, I associate being really, really cold with the misery and despair of being homeless. And that's, you know, everybody has their scars from different things that happens in their life. It's inevitable that you're going to accrue some scar tissue while living on this clay and granite planet. But for me, that was the one. That's the reason why I don't like the cold, apart from the fact that I grew up in a much warmer climate in Sydney, that period of homelessness had a profound effect on me, as it does. And being warm means that I'm okay. So, yeah, our minds are weird fucking things when we really drill it down to it a little bit. But anyway, I'm going to get on to cheerful stuff. What have I been watching? I'm up to 301 movies on the old Letterboxd list, which isn't too bad. Let me see what I've watched. The Pajama Game. I watched that, which is a musical from the 1950s starring Doris Day and John Raitt, based on a very, very successful Broadway play. Most of the cast were from the Broadway play. It's about people who work at a pajama factory and trying to get a pay rise and all that kind of stuff. It's not bad, but one bit of it pissed me off. And that is they're arguing for 7.5 cents an hour pay rise, which was okay at the time. But at the end of the movie, they find out that the guy running the factory has been pocketing the 7.5 cents, which the company's owners had agreed to months before. And he agrees to pay it back and gets away with having stolen all that money over the past number of months. And that pissed me off, because rich bastards should never get away with stealing. And so my Bolshevik side came to the rise and went, fuck this movie. It really does piss me off, the fact that this guy didn't go to jail from stealing all this money off the workers. So the Pajama Game's kind of tainted for me now. And, yeah, it was the 1950s and people didn't go to jail for ripping off their workers. They just went on to become very famous. But fuck that. I did see a movie from the 70s, which I saw in the cinema in the 70s, surprisingly enough. A movie called Chosen Survivors, which is a weird premise. It's a bunch of people who are put in a deep underground bunker because ostensibly there's a nuclear war and they're trying to save certain people with certain talents from being destroyed, and so they can repopulate the planet, blah, blah, blah. And they kind of get taken down to this very high-tech and 1970s futuristic bunker, and they start getting video messages about how they're supposed to survive. And then they find out there's a whole bunch of vampire bats in a cave attached to the bunker. And they start getting attacked by vampire bats and they've got to try to escape. Nice little premise. Very 70s kind of movie. Good cast, though. It's got people like Alex Cord, Bradford Dillman's in there, Diana Muldaur, Jackie Cooper, and a bunch of other people. Lincoln Kilpatrick plays one of the people in there as well. It's kind of 70s, and it's a bit of a bottle movie in the sense that it's all pretty much on one location. It's filmed in Mexico, and from all reports, a lot of bats they caught on a daily basis died making this movie. They just got killed by the heat of the lights. And so there was some arguments among the cast members who went on to get changes to the Screen Actors Guild Act to stop animal abuse in movies, even if they were filmed not in the USA. But that was kind of fun to watch. So then we did the usual seasonal movies. First one we saw was The Nightmare Before Christmas, which Sal's very, very fond of. So we watched that, and she was really nice to me this time because she didn't sing all the songs, because much as I love Sally, her voice is not the best. And so, you know, we kind of watched the movie, which isn't that long anyway, and it's cute, and the stop-motion animation is really nice. Not directed by Tim Burton, as a lot of people think. It was directed by Henry Selick, but Tim Burton had a lot to do with the creation of it. So we watched that on the 24th. Then we topped it off with the movie to end all Christmas movies, Die Hard, of course. Not the first time I've watched it, I'll be honest with you, but it's a lot of fun to watch, and it's become a Christmas tradition, and it's become an enormous social media meme to watch Die Hard and to argue with people who get a bit grumpy that it's a Christmas movie and fuck you guys for thinking it's not. So we watched that and enjoyed it all over again. There's always, I mean, just the way that the script and the plot and the direction by John McTiernan all puts together nicely. And Sal hasn't really paid attention when we watched it previously, but this time she went, oh, that really makes sense, that bit works, all this kind of stuff. So each time we watch it, we just learn a little bit more about the movie and enjoyed it. Then, of course, I watched the two movies we're going to talk about for this podcast, A Nightmare on Elm Street and Boar. More about those later. Then I watched Dendelier Than the Mail, the Richard Johnson movie based on the Bulldog Drummond novels from the 60s. Very Euro spy. It's got Elke Sommer and Silver Kashina wearing bikinis and carrying spear guns. That's all you need to know about the movie. Nigel Green plays a villain, and he's camping it up really nicely in this one. There was a sequel called Some Girls Do, which I'm going to watch in the next couple of days just to complete the set. It's a really silly movie, but it's a lot of fun, and there's some good location shooting in Italy on the coast, and yeah, it's worth checking out if you're a Eurospy fan. Then I saw Aquaman. I got a cheap ticket because I've got a loyalty card with the local cinemas, which gets me crazy cheap tickets, even with the discounts I get for having a seniors card. And so I paid like $10 to see Aquaman. And yeah, it kind of works. The bit that got me, I mean, Jason Momoa, not convinced that he's a wonderful actor, but I know that a lot of mums took their kids to see the movie because of Jason Momoa. The bit that really got me was his parents, played by Nicole Kidman and Tamara Morrison. They really work together. They've got nice chemistry. Their arc in the movie plays out really nicely. And particularly Tamara Morrison, one of the greatest actors of New Zealand, does a fantastic job in this movie. You've got a big supporting cast. Patrick Wilson's in there. You've got Willem Dafoe as well. And, of course, the state-of-the-art special effects. It's pretty damn good. I enjoyed it, but I don't think it's quite at the level of Marvel movies, which in some ways I suppose DC is trying to emulate. And there's nothing terribly, terribly surprising except for a kaiju-sized monster towards the end. Nonetheless, it's you know, by the books and by the beat plotting. There's the hero arc in there as well. And Amber Heard's pretty good playing Mira, the princess of one of the other kingdoms. We get Dolph Lundgren playing an underwater king, which is always nice fun. You should check it out. It's, like I said, I'm going to talk about it further because Lucas Garrett and I are going to do a whole podcast about it. But if you're kind of dithering on seeing it, just go see it for fuck's sake. Then you'll be part of the conversation. Then we saw The House with the Clock in Its Walls, which is a movie, a very atypical movie for Eli Roth, who normally does gory as fuck horror films. And it's got Jack Black in it and Cate Blanchett because Australians are everywhere these days. It's fun. It kind of works. It's about magic and an evil magician played by Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah, if you've got a kid, you can watch it with the kids. So it's a kid-friendly movie in that sense. And it works. I think there's a couple of patches where it slows down a little bit. but the characters have some nice arcs, all of them. We don't learn terribly much about Jack Black's character in the movie, but Cate Blanchett's character, Mrs. Zimmerman, has a really interesting backstory. So it's worth seeing. Check it out if you're so inclined. And we've just hit the 15-minute mark, so I should start talking about A Nightmare on Elm Street. I'll play the trailer and then explain why I'm talking about it on the podcast.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
You could just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Tina!
The coroner got to say.
He's in the jaw and puking since he saw it.
They're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails...
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive. Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay, so why am I doing A Nightmare on Elm Street for the podcast? It's all the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema's fault in the best possible way. And I keep saying the best possible way this time around, so that's not a negative thing. They did their annual Kris Kringle where people who are on their Facebook page get together and do a Kris Kringle across the planet. You agree to send a box of movie-related goodies to whoever you get on the Kris Kringle, and in return somebody else gives you a whole box full of goodies. I did that again this year, and the person who sent me a box full of wonderfulness is Derek Windmill, who, amongst other things, including an Evil Dead t-shirt, sent me all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies pretty much. There may be one or two there isn't. Let me have a look at the franchise list. So we've got Nightmare on Elm Street 1, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child, Freddy's Dead, Final Nightmare. I didn't get Wes Craven's New Nightmare, I don't think, but I might have. I'm not sure if I got Freddy vs. Jason, but I definitely got the 2010 remake, Nightmare on Elm Street, which stars Jackie Earle Haley as Freddy Krueger in this instance. I'm going to check it out, but the original is often the best, so we'll soon see. The movie was made in 1984 by Wes Craven, working with Bob Shea at New Line Cinema. It stars John Saxon, Ronnie Bleckley, Heather Langenkamp as Nancy, the protagonist. Johnny Depp, and there's an introducing Johnny Depp credit in this one, and Robert Englund playing Freddy Krueger. The premise is fairly simple. A bunch of teenagers on Elm Street in a town in Ohio start having the same dream, and they're attacked by a very similar figure in the dream. A guy in a battered hat with a red and green striped jersey, a disfigured face, and gloves with knives on the ends of the fingers. One by one, they start dying in very, very gory ways. And one of the teenagers, Nancy, whose father, Lieutenant Donald Thompson, is the police chief of the town, starts trying to find a way to fight back before she is killed by Freddy Krueger. She's the final girl, and she does a pretty good job. Heather Langenkamp's quite believable in this, with her 1980s perm, her slight overbite, and she kind of plays it well. She wasn't a particularly experienced actor at the time, but I think that this did play well. The movie cost about $1.8 million and ended up making $25 million for New Line. So obviously there were going to be sequels. And it's a lot of fun to watch. Revisiting it, there's nothing cringeworthy that I saw in it particularly, apart from Johnny Depp's utter lack of acting skills in it and his mullet. Yes, he was young at the time, and he was still to do 21 Jump Street and all those things that catapulted his career. But he doesn't have a lot of charisma in this one. Even though it's a secondary role, I think that you should have at least tried to bring your A-game to it, and he definitely doesn't do that. We've got John Saxon, of course, who'd been in movies since the 1950s and had been in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, and who at this stage of his career was still doing a comb-over. So he's quite good at it. Amanda Wisp plays Tina, one of Nancy's friends, and she's kind of cool in this one as well. Ronnie Blakely, who is in Nashville, plays Nancy's mum, Marge Thompson, who's an alcoholic and quite free with her charms, let's say. I've got to be honest, if there's the least valuable player in this movie, apart from Johnny Depp, it's got to be Ronnie Blakely, who doesn't put a lot of energy into the role. We also get a small role by Lynn Shay, who was Robert Shay's sister, who went on to, in later life, be the mainstay of the Insidious series of horror movies. So she's got a long career in the genre. Wes Craven's script is really lovely worked out too. He kind of applies this concept. There's a ghost or the spirit or the body or mind of a child murderer. Freddy is a child murderer in the first series. In the remake in 2010, it becomes a child molester and child killer, which gives it an edgier edge. But I always assumed that Freddy was a child molester and killer. There's no point in killing children unless you've molested them, really, is there? That's gone down a dark path very fast. So basically, he comes in, the spirit of Freddy Krueger comes into people's dreams and kills them in their dreams, particularly young people, as revenge against their parents who basically tortured and killed him because the law couldn't touch him. This brings up a few interesting concepts. First off, the problems of vigilante justice and unforeseen consequences thereof. And the second point is that the sins of the parents are then brought down to the children, which, if you ask me, is a bit stupid. Freddy should have been killing the parents, not the kids. Some of the parents are doing a pretty good job of killing themselves. For instance, Nancy's mother, Marge, is drinking herself to death, and her father, who is a cop, seems to be working himself to death. So Freddy's job is being done for him. But Freddy, by populating the dreams and by using them in a very elaborate manner with a great forethought and a great instinct for dream logic and for monstering people while they sleep, he's a Leonardo da Vinci of fucking people up in their dreams, which is part of the fun of this movie, of course. Even though it's dark, it doesn't have quite the nightmarish tones of a much more serious movie. And I kind of like that. And then we get to the point of Nancy. She's trying to stay awake. She's got coffee pots around her bedroom. She's got one hidden in her cupboard, which is actually based on some stuff that Wes Craven read about a real-life case where a guy who'd escaped the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia had this idea in his head that he was going to be killed in his dream. So he had a coffee pot stashed away in his cupboard in his bedroom and that kind of thing. And eventually he unfortunately died. But Wes Craven had gathered all these little bits of macabre news information and rolled them into the idea of Freddy Krueger, which is a good creation. He's a good, solid monster creation. We know what he does. He does something unusual. He comes into people's dreams and kills them in their dreams so that when they're the most vulnerable, when they're at a time of the day-night cycle when they should be healing, they're actually being harmed. And it's quite a valid and interesting concept, the idea that somebody else is in charge of your nightmares instead of you. And, you know, that thing in your nightmares when you can sometimes manipulate things to your end and that you can wake up once you realize it's a dream. Freddy kind of short circuits that and stops you from doing it, which is kind of cool. Now, Nancy isn't giving up. Nancy's a tough person. So there's a few, she's a cop's daughter too, so that's probably part of it. The upbringing and the environment of being able to look after yourself is probably part of her education, even though her mother is drunk. But Nancy decides that she's going to fight Freddy, and she does it a couple of ways. Firstly, by trying to stay awake. She's trying to get time to get information, which is perfectly valid under the circumstances. Even though everybody else thinks that she's distraught because her friends are starting to die and that kind of thing, they're misjudging her and don't understand. She goes to a sleep clinic with a sleep doctor played by Charles Fleischer, who was the voice of Roger Rabbit, amongst other things. And she finds out a couple of things. First thing is she can bring things out of the dream state when she's in Freddy's dreams. She brings his hat out. And that then leads her to what she plans to do. She plans to bring Freddy out of the dream with her by letting him think he's got her and then grabbing him and waking up. She gets her stupid boyfriend to try to help her, but her boyfriend's as useful as tits on a ball, so that doesn't really pan out. And then she does something else which is really kind of weird and wonderful. She booby traps her house so that when she brings Freddy out, she can basically attack him with booby traps, sledgehammers mounted above doors, pots of hot water, everything she can think of as an improvised booby trap in an urban situation. She sets it up, so she's well planned. I mean, she takes the steps, she realizes what's at stake, and she takes steps to deal with it. And I like that. I like that kind of audacity. I like the fact she does her homework, not just off the internet, because the internet didn't exist in 1984, but she gets books about improvised warfare because, oddly enough, you could get them in the 80s. Let me have a look over here. I'm looking over at one of the bookshelves here in the mess that is the man cave, and yep, I've got a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook and the Poor Man's James Bond, both of which are very, very hard to find these days. And if applied properly and if you can get the materials, they're pretty much, those two books are what you need to start an urban insurgency. She didn't hear that from me. So Nancy decides to do that, and she decides that she's going to go toe-to-toe with Freddy, which I really like as a concept. It's a little bit Ripley from Alien kind of thing, which is good, and it's somebody who won't become a victim. She doesn't want to be a victim. She won't be a victim. She's already been messed around by Freddy. There's the scene which has got lots and lots of subtext to it and lots of symbolism to it, where Nancy is dozing in the bathtub and Freddy's claw comes up between her legs under the water and drags her down under the water. There's a lot of symbolism in that scene, let's say. If you don't know what I mean, ask your mummy. There's the tongue foam, where the foam becomes Freddy's tongue licking the side of her face, which is crazily icky and horrible. And before I forget it, there's the fact that Freddy can change the physical world. When the Amanda Wiss character is attacked by Freddy, Wes Craven uses a very old trick which dates back at least as far as Royal Wedding, the Fred Astaire movie from the early 1950s, which is using a rotating room to show somebody being dragged up a wall and across a ceiling. Now, Fred Astaire didn't use it that way. He used it as a way of dancing three-dimensionally. But in Nightmare on Elm Street, they use it to see that secondary female character, Tina, being dragged across the room and up the walls and onto the ceiling before she's disemboweled and spun around and sprays the room and her boyfriend with her blood and guts, because redecorating is a thing Freddy seems to be into. Nancy gets a grey streak in her hair from one of her encounters with Freddy, which is kind of cool, but not necessarily scientifically accurate. The other thing I like is the fact that she seems to get all of the booby traps in the house that she's going to plan to grab, attack Freddy with, set up in a 20-minute period, because she tells her father to come into the house from the house across the street where he's investigating the murder of Johnny Depp's character, and spoiler there, in 20 minutes. And in 20 minutes, she seems to do a hell of a lot of stuff. She is crazily efficient when it comes to housework, especially improvised weapons in the house. She sets all this shit up in 20 minutes, which is a slight weakness in the script, and a quick rewrite may well have fixed it. And then she gets into Freddy's world, which is kind of interesting too, because the way Nancy gets into Freddy's world is by going down into the cellar of her house and then finding a secret doorway which leads to a deeper cellar which is full of steam pipes and spiral staircases. And it's the world beneath the world where Freddy lives. And that's kind of a cool concept, which is kind of physically shown rather than told or done with fancy special effects. She descends into the hell that is the place where Freddy Krueger lives. And I really like that as an approach to this. These days, there may have been some kind of fancy CG effect to cover that, but I think the physical effect of climbing down into different environments works really, really well with that. Now, it's a great stunt work in this movie as well. There's a really fantastic fire stunt where Freddy's set on fire, which was done in one take and involves staircases, which is bloody difficult with a fire stunt. The stunt work in this movie is not particularly complex, but it's done really well, and it's done really pointedly to an effect. It's not your standard stunt work in some ways, but it really does give us a good sense of the world. And there's some nice second unit stuff in here as well. There's a scene where the staircase inside the house becomes full of mushy stairs. The stairs turn into kind of glue and trap Nancy's feet as she's climbing the stairs. And that's, again, dream logic. It's you know, the kind of surreal alteration of reality that you would get in a dream. And it does give us a kind of intensified sense that this world is manipulable and protean. And I really like that. I like the fact that by using physical effects, they can suggest so much more than the physical effects themselves are actually showing. Funnily enough, Robert Englund wasn't the first choice to play Freddy Krueger. David Warner, the English actor, was originally going to play Freddy. I'm just reading this off Wikipedia, so excuse me if it sounds a bit stilted. They did some makeup effects, but he had to drop out due to scheduling conflicts. Robert Englund wasn't necessarily the first choice. The previous roles I'd seen him in things like V, the TV series, he was playing much more amiable characters. By the way, I just did a check, and that David Warner story I just told you is bullshit, according to some sources. But one of the other things that's really interesting, and this, of course, changes in the further sequels and remake, is in this movie, Freddy's only on the screen for 7 minutes, which is kind of interesting because he has such, he's such a presence in the movie that to have him in there for less than 1/10 of the time, let's say 1/15 of the running time of this movie, is kind of a credit to how iconic the character is and how striking. The gloves, the hat, the striped vest, the scarred face, and these makeup guys did look at burns victims, photos of burns victims from various hospitals to get the look for Freddy Krueger. So it's a very visceral look. And in some of the sequels, it's a lot more apparent that Freddy's disfiguration is pretty fucking chronic. But 7 minutes of Freddy Krueger in this movie, and that's a credit to A, Wes Craven, of course, for filming it, but also for the way Robert Englund plays it. He said he based the physicality of Freddy Krueger on Nosferatu, the Murnau movie from the silent film era. And I know that Robert Englund is a film buff and also a theatre buff, and had a wide theatrical background in theatre as well. So he would have used that kind of stuff to kind of help with a role, because there are really no markers for a role like that. At least I'm going to base it on the previous people that played Freddy Krueger, because there was nobody before him. One of the other things that's really interesting too is that at a certain point in the movie, and I'm not sure where the point is, but it's a kind of piece in the movie, about 2/3 of the way through, we start to get into a place where we don't know which part of the film is when the characters are awake and which part is a nightmare. That stuff begins to blur. I mean, is Freddy actually coming out of the dream or not? Or is the parts where we think Freddy is coming out of the dream actually part of the nightmare, and it's Freddy gaming the characters? And that's kind of cool too, because when the line between reality and dreaming is totally obliterated in the movie, it just makes it that much stronger. And it also makes that ending, that twist ending, which I'm not going to spoil. If you haven't seen it, I'm still not going to spoil it for you. But it makes that twist ending a lot more plausible by having that gradual kind of dissolving of reality and dissolving of the certainty of reality that we have in this film. And that's kind of cool. Where movies blur the lines is always the most interesting place. You see it at the end of Dead of Night, the 1946 portmanteau horror film that the Brits did. I think it may have been Ealing did it. You see that kind of place where reality falls off a cliff. And in this movie, you don't see reality fall off a cliff. What you see is a reality slowly dissolve like an Alka-Seltzer in a glass of water. And I really like that. It makes it a little bit more than your average 1980s horror film. And it's probably one of the reasons why it does have so many sequels, because there is no certainty. There is no firm footing for the characters in this film. It makes it so much fun. Like I said, I didn't have a copy of this movie, and it wasn't on my list of movies to get either. But now that I've watched it, and thank you again, Derek, for putting it into Kris Kringle, it's worthwhile seeing, and I'm going to do the sequels as well. I may well do them as episodes of the podcast. Let me know if you'd like me to do the Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street sequels as a continuing series of one of the two movies in each of the podcasts, because I'll be on for that, and I'd be happy to do it, because I like the character, I like the world that they create, even though they did it on, even for the time, a fairly small budget. And there was a stage where a lot of their budget fell through. The deal they had with a certain company to finance the movie fell through, and Robert Shea had to do some major Hollywood hustling to get the rest of the funding while the film was already under production. And, of course, everybody got much more than their money back, which is kind of cool. But this movie worked for me. It worked in, even now. There are movies from that time. There are even kind of some certain iconic movies from the 1980s that don't work for us these days. But this one does. It's still got whatever it is that makes this kind of medium budget horror movie plausible to us and kind of fun for us. A Nightmare on Elm Street definitely has that. And it's kind of a rare thing when people were pumping out this kind of product a lot. Home video was coming in, so there was the rent-through advantage of putting out cheap product quickly. The sell-through market hadn't quite started yet, at least here in Australia. But it would soon do that and, of course, increase the amount of profit that A Nightmare on Elm Street made. But this one is definitely in that sweet spot of 1980s VHS era horror, and yet it's still incredibly watchable in 2018. So anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about a 2017 movie, which I think is better than Razorback, and it's a movie called Boar, starring John Jarrett, Roger Ward, Simone Buchanan, and a bunch of other sort of semi-famous, at least in Australia, actors who did a very interesting little horror film. But before I do that, I've got some special music for you, because while I was roaming through and while there was a sale on at JB Hi-Fi, I found a very unusual little album. And it's called Jeff Goldblum and the Mildred Snitzer Orchestra, the Capitol Studio Session. And it's a jazz album from 2018 by Jeff Goldblum, which is fucking weird for a start. But I'm going to play a track from it. And it is a duet between Jeff Goldblum and Sarah Silverman singing Me and My Shadow. And it's silly. Doesn't look like it's overly rehearsed, but it seems like they're having a hell of a lot of fun. And when I get back, I'm going to be talking about a giant pig movie.
Like the wallpaper sticks to the wall.
Like the seashore clings to the sea.
Like you'll never get rid of your shadow, Sarah.
Jeff, you'll never get rid of me.
Good news. Let all the others fight and fuss. Whatever happens, we've got us. We're closer than pages that stick in a book. We're closer than ripples that play in a brook. Perfect. Wherever you find her, you'll find me just one. Closer than a miser or the bloodhounds to Liza me.
Closer than Smog is to all of L.A. We're closer than Bobby is to JFK.
Not a soul can bust this team into. We stick together like glue.
And when it's sleeping time,
that's when we're gonna rise.
We'll start to swing. That's
when we swing to the skies.
Our clocks don't shine.
Was a prize they ring
a ding ding happy new year.
And now to repeat what I said
and
at the start,
my
They need a large crowbar to bust us apart. We're alone but far from blue.
Before we get finished, we'll make the town roar.
We'll change that name, Redskins. Is that such a chore?
Then we'll tackle climate change. Hats off to Al Gore.
Life is gonna be wee wah wee for my Hey, Sarah. Wait a minute. Till Brunner. Is that the best trumpet you've ever heard in your life?
It's like cutting butter with a hot knife.
Yes, you phrase maker. Well put. Hey, recently I've been keeping my butter out at night. So that it's soft in the morning. Is that risky? I love soft butter.
It's not risky. You can do that with butter. You can leave it out.
Okay, I'm taking that to the bank. What was I going to say now? Oh, I know. Could you do me a favor, Sarah?
Yes, anything.
Could we take it just one more time?
From the top?
No, from that ending. I love that ending.
Before we get finished, we'll make the town roar.
We're just like Michael Corleone. We'll settle old scores.
Oh, then we'll talk to Vitero and horse.
Life is gonna be wee-wah-wee for tonight. Is Shadow and me. In Jurassic Park, scary in the dark.
I am scared that I'll get eaten.
Oh, Sarah, don't be scared of that. Silverman, ladies and gentlemen, my God, a national treasure, international treasure, cosmic treasure, my God. There she goes, there she goes. Touch her, but not too vociferously. This is the chair that she had her.
What a trick to throw into the middle of a podcast about a couple of horror movies. Though there is a Jurassic Park reference in there, I suppose, so that kind of covers it. Sometimes it's good to just hear a track where the two people singing are just having a great time with it. I like that track a lot. Anyway, it's on to talk about Boar, and to do that, I'm going to play you the trailer.
Okay, cabin fever is officially set in. I suggest the next town we come to, we pull over and get some grub.
Good idea.
Sounds great.
Tearing the fences down there at the old Patterson's farm there.
He's down a few sheep too. Huh? Something's killed them, yeah.
Well, what, all nine of them?
There's nothing out there except dust and ruse.
That's a load of shit, Ernie, and you know it.
You remember that smash up on the highway coming into town, right, about 12 months ago? They couldn't find the couple. All the police found was the wrecked car. I was driving back from Bob's place in me truck and I saw something in the paddock about 300 or 400 metres off, and I hit the spotty on it. It was a boar.
Wild pig!
Okay, Boar is a 2017 Australian horror film directed by Chris Sun, who'd previously done a couple of other horror movies, including something called Charlie's Farm, which I just read about and which I will probably now see based on what I've read. Now, Boar didn't get very much love on the IMDb, 5.1 out of 10, but I like it a lot more than that. I think it's got some stuff going for it. It balances out humour and horror in a nice way. With humour and horror, it's one of those things where you can kind of go too much one way or too much the other. This one balances it out quite nicely. Now, I like the cast as well. There's a lot of Australian jobbing actors in this one. Nathan Jones plays Bernie, a great big hulk of a guy, because Nathan Jones was a mixed martial arts fighter as well as having a career in wrestling as well. He started out as a teenager. He was done for armed robbery and spent some time in jail where he started powerlifting. And he's a big guy, big, bald, buffy Queensland guy. And this one is kind of nice because he plays a character called Uncle Bernie, who's a big teddy bear of a guy who's also built like a brick shit house and is willing to punch out a giant pig, should it be called for. You got Bill Moseley, an American actor who's been in a lot of horror movies, House of a Thousand Corpses, The Devil's Rejects, all those sort of things. You get John Jarrett, who people know from Wolf Creek. Now, John Jarrett, I've got mixed feelings about because I don't know whether it's been widely broadcast overseas, but there are some historic rape allegations against him and which are going to trial, which I find troubling. Let's put it that way. You get a 5-second cameo from Steve Bisley, who was in the original Mad Max, of course, film not too far from here. And a friend of the podcast, Roger Ward, turns up as a rouge shooter called Blue. And Roger seems to be having a great time in this movie. He's really grooving on it, having fun. There are some scenes set in a pub run by Melissa Kautz, an actress who is mostly known for Australian soap operas. But there's a lot of nice kind of pub dialogue scenes in this movie that really work and give us that kind of laconic, laid-back country Australian humour. It's Simone Buchanan playing the mother of a family, Debbie. Simone Buchanan started out doing ingenue roles in Australian television. We get Chris Haywood playing Jack. I like Chris Haywood a lot. He's been on the Australian scene all through the Ausploitation era and the Australian Renaissance in cinema. We get Ernie Dingo playing a character, oddly enough, called Ernie. Ernie Dingo is one of our great Indigenous actors, and in this one he does get to do a couple of bits of business. He's not really essential to the plot. He's more background character with a bit of fun, but chucking him in there is a kind of reassuring thing for Australian audiences, seeing him in there. And there are a bunch of other actors in there as well, but they're the ones that I liked. So the story is pretty basic and pretty simple. In the outback, there's a beast, an enormous feral pig, roughly the size of a large rhinoceros, which basically is defending its territory and attacking anything that comes in its way that looks like food. There's a nice bit at the start where there are a couple of New Zealand tourists who are travelling through, and we see their car get attacked by the pig, because the pig's bigger than a car. It will just barrel over pretty much any reasonably sized vehicle it sees in order to get the juicy goods inside. And this one definitely does. The Kiwi tourists, who some people may not even recognise as New Zealanders, because some people have trouble differentiating between Australian and New Zealand accents, which is not something Australians or New Zealanders have. But it's kind of nice, and it gives that Antipodean feel, including a couple of New Zealand actors in there. Inevitably, there are going to be comparisons between this movie and Razorback. And Razorback, Russell Mulcahy's movie from the 1980s, is pretty good. It was all filmed around Silverton in New South Wales. This one actually was filmed in Gympie in Queensland, so it was in southern Queensland where Boar was filmed. Totally different kind of landscape, rolling hills, a little bit lush and a little bit greener, but still kind of rural Australian with the gum trees and tree stumps and all those kinds of things, and more rivers than you get, of course, out near Silverton, because any river you get at Silverton's probably going to last about 3 weeks before it dries up. And at the moment out that way, which is Broken Hill, Silverton, right at the west of New South Wales, they're going through a crazy drought, but I won't go into the geopolitics and water politics of that. There is a little kind of reflection of Chinatown about the way water management's being done in that part of the world. So anyway, while there are those comparisons with Razorback, the director Chris Sun has said that his influences for Bourke came from two other places. First off, American Werewolf in London and the country scenes between Griffin Dunne and David Norton kind of helped with that, and Jaws. So they're the two influences there, and I can see that it's definitely part of the mix, and it works really well for that. Now, the giant pig, of course, is the crux of the movie. You, just like Bruce the Shark was in Jaws and the werewolf transformation in American Werewolf in London, the pig's got to be good. And it's an animatronic puppet for the most part. There are some bits that may be computer-enhanced when the puppet moves because there's a guy sitting inside the puppet. And there, if you look at the extras on the DVD, I actually got the Blu-ray, sorry, the Blu-ray, you can see the construction of the giant pig and how hands-on Chris Sun was, and he knew exactly what he wanted. This pig has seen better days. It's gnarly. Its tusks are kind of cracked and broken. It seems to be blind in one eye. Its hair is matted. Not exactly like wild pigs are for the most part, because wild pigs tend to have bristles. And pig bristles are a lot, they're kind of halfway between hair and porcupine quills. But this one, he seems to be some kind of hybrid because his hair is softer but very patchy. There's scar tissue all over him. He's a really old thing. He's almost like a force of nature or a spirit in the same sense that, say, in a Miyazaki film, you get those monstrous spirits in Princess Mononoke and things like that. He's like this pig has come out of Princess Mononoke in some ways into the real world. And it works. There are one or two moments when it doesn't quite look realistic, but that inevitably happens with any kind of animatronic beast. But in this case, it worked for me for the most part of the film. Even before you see it clearly, it's set up as being a difficult to manage kind of creature. We see it knock over cars. We see it knock over fences. We see it attack people viciously and nastily. And so even before you do get that clear view of it, they build the hype. They build up the tension. We know that this is an incredibly powerful beast. And basically it's protecting its territory, which is a wide-ranging territory. And one of the things this film does quite well, from my point of view at least, is give a sense of how big the outback in Australia is. Because the people and the pig travel over a wide range during this movie, and through using the driving scenes and using the landscapes well, Chris Sun does give us a good sense of size here, because in that kind of a landscape, even a pig the size of a rhinoceros is easy not to see, because there are hills and valleys and trees. If it's ranging around mostly at night time, you won't see it anyway. And there is a scene where Chris Hayward's character talks about spotlighting it with his truck spotlight while driving along in the nighttime. And that gives us that plausibility into the fact that this thing hasn't really been seen or identified and is more kind of an urban, or not an urban, but a country legend, that there's some kind of big beast out there knocking down fences and killing sheep and cattle and generally wreaking havoc. I know a little bit about pigs because part of my childhood, I grew up on a farm where they had pigs. And I like them. They're intelligent. They're not necessarily hostile unless you go near sow's piglets, in which case you may be in some trouble. I know what it feels like to kind of rub the back of a pig. I know what the bristles feel like in the skin. Flesh is very human-like even when they're alive, which is kind of disturbing in some ways. But at one stage, there were some sheep that died on the farm, and they fed the carcasses to the pigs. And that really gave me an idea of the omnivorous nature of pigs and the fact that they ripped into the guts of the sheep. This didn't disturb me too much when I was a kid. They tried to stop me looking because, you know, they thought it might disturb me, but it really didn't. And, seeing the guts and the blood and all that kind of stuff and seeing what was left after the pigs had a go at it over a couple of days, it gave me respect for the fact that pigs are omnivorous and will eat a lot of meat if they need to. And that, of course, happens to various people during this movie, which kind of has a plausibility to me because of that real-life experience. There's a couple of great death scenes. Roger Ward gets a fantastic death scene. John Jarrett does as well. And in spite of my problems with John Jarrett because of his behaviours, he does, these old guys, him and Roger Ward's character Blue, really do, first off, they have a good sense of friendship. And also, they're tough old country guys. And they play that really nicely. And the fact that they're not going to take shit from a pig, even though it doesn't necessarily end well for them, let's say, there's a kind of audacity and a toughness and a ruggedness about these guys, which really works well in the context of the movie. And it's partly down to the skills of those actors, because they're both highly skilled actors. And Roger Ward in particular, I love as an actor, because he's got a kind of old school Australian blokiness about him, which I really kind of like. So, of course, Sally got him to do a promotion for this very podcast.
Hi, this is Roger Ward. You're listening to Martian Drive-In. Enjoy.
Which is kind of cool. So just to kind of summarise on Boar, it's a good, honest, old-fashioned monster movie. It works kind of well. If you grew up in Australia and you've lived here for the last time, you'll know a lot of the actors who from their earlier work. And it kind of makes it a little bit more fun, even if you don't know them. They're good, honest actors. They've been working in the industry for a number of years. There's a good combination of older and younger actors in there, which kind of works well for it. And it's got that over-the-top silliness at times, which really enhances the innately crazy concept of the movie in ways that are really interesting. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I expected to. There have been some Australian horror movies which go the full gore and do things in, you know, kind of self-serious ways. They can take themselves a little bit too seriously. But Boar does a good balance on that. Doesn't take itself too serious. Gives us a decent monster. Gives us some craziness and ultimately entertains us, which of course is the thing that we need to remember, that these movies were designed to do that. They were designed to entertain us, delight us, and make us give money to the people who made the movie. So yeah, if you get a chance to check it out, I don't think you'll be too disappointed with it. And that is really one ugly looking pig. So that's about it this time around. Thank you for listening. I'll be back early in the new year with another Paleo Cinema podcast and another Martian Drive-In podcast, both of which have got some interesting things coming up in them. I've got a couple of movies that I've wanted to do for a long time that I've finally got copies of, and I'll be doing them particularly for Paleo, but also for Martian. Early in the new year, as I said earlier, I'm getting Lucas Garrett to come back on board, and we're going to cover Aquaman and anything else that takes our fancy. But in the meantime, I hope you have a great new year. I hope 2019 does for you all the things you want it to. I hope that anything nasty that happens is minor. Anything good that happens is enormous. And thanks for your support in 2018 amongst all of those previous years of the podcast as well. It's been a good year for me in a lot of ways. It's been challenging at times as well. And I'm enjoying the changes that 2018 has brought, and the 2019 will inevitably bring. So take care of yourselves. I'll be back very soon. Watch some good movies, watch some bad movies, keep watching the skies. And here, of course, are the credits to the podcast in the style of movie credits to honour the Patreon subscribers. I'll catch you later. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of movie credits to honour the people who support this podcast. Thank you to Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Jan, the dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, T, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, our set photographer, Mark D, our extra, and David L, our extra, Kerry H, who is the accountant, and our newest supporter, Gary J, who is a CGFX technician. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. I really appreciate you dipping into your purses and helping out with the podcast.